From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscoane, sitting in for Terry Gross. On today's archive edition of Fresh Air, we feature interviews with two people who have followed in the footsteps of their parents. First, stand-up comic and performance artist Marga Gomez. Her parents always wanted to be famous, but never were. Her mother was a Puerto Rican exotic dancer, and her father, a Cuban comic. Gomez's show, Memory Tricks, is partly Gomez's attempt to bring her parents the show business acclaim they always wanted. Ben Cheever, on the other hand, grew up the son of a famous writer, the late John Cheever. Ben was hailed as a major new comic writer after the debut of his first novel. Now he's got a second novel, The Partisan. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Sleep With Angels, Neil Young's newest album. That's all coming up on today's archive edition of Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Democratic Representative Mel Reynolds of Chicago has been indicted on charges of sexual assault and obstruction of justice. The allegations involve a former campaign worker. The Cook County State's attorney says Reynolds has been asked to surrender and won't be arrested out of respect for the office of a member of the U.S. House of Representatives. The 42-year-old congressman is seeking a second term and says he will be vindicated. President Clinton says he won't let Cuban President Fidel Castro dictate U.S. immigration policy. He's now barred illegal Cuban refugees from entering the United States. When they're intercepted, they'll be returned to the U.S. naval base in Cuba for processing. This is a major change in American-Cuban policy, which was enacted during the Cold War. During the president's news conference today, he also expressed support for a 10% cut in his crime bill. Congressional Republicans want to whittle down the cost of the bill. President Clinton says his goals will still be met.
The principles of the bill are intact. It's the biggest increase in police in the history of the country. It's the toughest increase in punishment in the history of the country. It's the biggest increase in prevention programs in the history of the country. I'm not a member of the Congress. They have to work out all the details. If they'd produced this bill out of the conference, I would have happily supported this as I did the other one.
The House is supposed to meet tomorrow and vote on the reworked bill if agreement can be reached on the changes. NAACP Executive Director Benjamin Chavis says he won't resign his office. Chavis appeared today at a news conference with a woman who reportedly had accused him of sexually harassing her. Susan Tisdale rejected those allegations today and berated the media and members of the NAACP board for believing them. Chavis is embroiled in another sexual harassment suit. He had started to use NAACP funds to prevent the woman from filing the suit. He insists he is not guilty of harassment and has done nothing wrong.
When you're the subject of daily news coverage, most of which is inaccurate and based on false information, it does take its toll. But as I said a few days ago, I do have no intentions of resigning from the NAACP. I have violated no rules. I have violated no policies. I violated no procedures.
Two NAACP board meetings are scheduled for tomorrow in Baltimore to examine Chavis's performance in office. Weather forecasters are saying the threat of Hurricane Chris to the United States is lessening. The National Weather Service says Chris is turning to the north in the Atlantic Ocean and is traveling even more northerly than expected. Chris has gathered more strength. The Weather Service says the storm could pass Bermuda in 2 or 3 days. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average has fallen more than 2 points to 3,753. In over-the-counter trading, the Nasdaq is up a point at 742. This is NPR. A federal appeals court has ruled two L.A. police officers convicted for beating motorist Rodney King were sentenced far too leniently. The 9th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals has ordered resentencing for Sergeant Stacy Kuhn and Officer Lawrence Powell. Both received sentences of 2.5 years in prison, and that's far below federal guidelines for their crimes. The court did not specify a new sentence. It has left this up to the original judge to do. Hutu refugees are fleeing Rwanda for Zaire now that French troops are leaving their posts in the safe haven they created for the refugees. The Hutus fear reprisals from the new Tutsi-led Rwandan government. Zairean officials say they'll close one of their borders if another Rwandan exodus starts. The BBC's Jane Stanley reports.
Zaire's apparent decision to close its border with the French protection zone in southwestern Rwanda has caused confusion. The Office of the United Nations Refugee Agency, UNHCR, here in the border town of Bukavu, said its headquarters in the Zairean capital Kinshasa had been officially informed the border would be closed for what the Zairean authorities called security reasons. The decision was expected by aid workers to have been implemented immediately, but refugees fleeing the French zone are still crossing into Zaire at an estimated rate of 15,000 people a day. Many thousands more can be seen behind them, heading out of Rwanda before France completes the withdrawal of its forces at the weekend. Aid workers fear the refugees may rush in panic over the small wooden bridge if they find out about Zaire's decision to bar their exit from Rwanda.
Jane Stanley reporting. The Vatican says the Pope hopes to celebrate Mass at a bombed-out skating rink next month in Sarajevo. The trip would be Pope John Paul's first to the former Yugoslavia, but the Holy See says that it could cancel Pope John Paul's visit if fighting in the capital escalates. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Marga Gomez was born into a showbiz family. Her father was a Cuban-born comedian. Her mother was a Puerto Rican exotic dancer. The three of them used to perform together on the stages of New York City's now famous Latino theaters. Her parents never made it big time, but they turned their daughter into a performer. Marga Gomez first established her own reputation as an actress and comedian in San Francisco in the early 80s. Her blend of social commentary, storytelling, and sexual politics made her a favorite in many of the local clubs and cabarets. I spoke with Gomez last year when her one-woman show, Memory Tricks, opened in New York. Gomez began writing the piece when her mother was first diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease. It's both a funny and tragic story of the stormy relationship she had with her mother from childhood to the present. Memory Tricks begins with Marga's parents arguing with each other about who loves her more.
One day, after school, I heard my parents talking in the dining room, and since it didn't sound like they were having a fight, I figured it was safe to go downstairs. It turned out that they were having a debate over who was my favorite parent. My father was a comedian. His stage name was Willie Huesito de Nylon Chevalier. Maybe you heard of him. And my mother was a dancer, and her stage name was Margot the Exotic. And I was the only child that they would ever have together. My father doted on me. He had all these nicknames for me. He used to call me Ms. Gomez, Lieutenant, my little girl. Would you kindly come and sit for a momentito? Siéntate, my darling. I'm going to ask you a little question. I want you to thin it over. Okie dokie. Who do you love more? Me? Your daddy? Your captain? Your fiancé, or your mother? What you think, Mimi? What you say, Champy? Come, 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 my dear child. Who's number one?
Gee, Daddy, I love you both. I love you both the same.
Margita, you can only pick one. Now, tell the truth. Tell your father who you love the most. Are you going to pick a man who couldn't get out of bed for your first communion because he was out all night with his garbage friends? Cállate, Cheva. I am talking now. Are you going to pick him, or are you going to pick your mother who takes care of you, who takes you to the doctor when you're sick, who takes you everywhere, everywhere that you need to go, who buys your clothes and pays for them with her own money? Tell me right now, Marga Gomez. Because if you want your father so much, then I can have another child.
Well, it's real close. If I had to say, I guess that I do. Then I guess that I would pick you, Mom. Did you hear that, Cheva? A daughter wants to be with her mother. La madre is number one, and that will never change. Nunca. Nunca.
How much did your parents fight over your affections?
Well, you know, my parents fought over everything, and my affections were just one of the trophies. They were very competitive. They were in a competitive business. They were up from poverty and immigrants, so they were just, they seemed to turn all the pain that they were experiencing in their lives against themselves and against each other. So they definitely, I was just sort of this amusing little prize that went back and forth. And, I think that when they were together, that was just kind of, I mean, it was almost like a play fighting thing too, you know. It's kind of one of the, just the ways they related to each other. I mean, they had separate rooms from, like, as long as I can remember. My dad had a room, she had a room, I had a room, the Chihuahua had a room. We were very close-knit family. I had a very skewed view on family life growing up.
Let me ask you, as an only child, as you said, the only child your parents ever had together, did that make you really an expert on your parents? You had the ability to watch them without being distracted by brothers and sisters.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I was an intimate with them, a colleague, and I was also around all their very showy, unusual, flamboyant friends, like Daisy, the crazy dancer. You know, they one time they threw a birthday party for me, and they threw it at 10 o'clock. You know, after shows on a school night, so none of my childhood friends could come, but all their friends came.
Did you have childhood friends? I mean, kids, friends that were your own age?
I had, I had a little friend around the corner. She was an Italian, of Italian descent, and, she was always telling me what her parents said about the Puerto Ricans and stuff, which never, really clicked with me because I didn't realize, I was Puerto Rican, which I am, Puerto Rican and Cuban. But I had I was a Catholic school kid. I went to Catholic school for a few years, just enough to destroy my self-esteem. And we were little frightening Tasmanian Catholic school kids, really bratty, super bratty. I mean, I used to do all these pranks. I could only really produce with intense supervision. I need a very tough director because I'm used to nuns. and so, like, once we got out of school, we'd do terrible things to the New Yorkers. You know, like, we go and throw boxes down on the subway during rush hour. And we never hurt anybody, but just annoy people really a lot.
Now, did kids in the neighborhood envy you because your parents were actors and in the theater? Was there something exotic about your life?
Yes and no. A lot of people in the neighborhood were afraid of my parents because, there was a lot of old world superstition, and my parents were only seen leaving the house at night with dark glasses on, so they thought they were vampires.
That's in your piece, but that's really how people felt about your parents, that they truly were vampires.
Well, my parents were weird, yeah. I mean, they didn't really relate to anybody in the neighborhood, and my parents definitely tried to pretend that they were in Hollywood, and it's just this house happened to be on 169th Street in Manhattan, but they were actually in Hollywood, living out, a Hollywood dream.
So they had powerful imaginations.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I mean, they were deluded, I guess, and so was I. I was taught to be deluded as a child.
Now, you did perform with your parents at times.
Oh, yeah. When I was a kid, they would... my parents met... In the shows in Latino theaters, in the 60s or 50s. And so they would do this. My father would write these sketches. He put these shows together, and he would have a sketch, sort of towards the end called La Familia Cómica, The Funny Family. And he had it, he had about, 20, 30 sketches, and he would just do them to death. And occasionally in the sketch, there would be, you'd need a child, and so they would use me because they wouldn't have to pay me. And same thing with a Chihuahua. They'd use a dog. Our dog wouldn't have to pay the dog either.
Now, did you like being on stage with your parents?
Of course. I mean, I wanted to actually take over there. I definitely had a large ego as a small child. And I was comfortable. I mean, I was always comfortable on stage or backstage or anything to do with live performance. It's a lot easier to figure out than making movies.
Now, your mother was known as Margot the Exotic. Just how exotic a dancer was she?
Well, when she first started dancing, she was an Afro-Cuban dancer, and she became a dancer so she could make money to take acting lessons, because that's really what she wanted to do, was be a movie star. And, for reasons of, I guess, racial bias, she never got to get very far in that department. She was just an extra. So she was an Afro-Cuban dancer, and then she learned belly dancing. And she started dancing in clubs like, I guess she danced at the Waldorf Astoria, and then she would do a lot of Anglo nightclubs with, you know, like, comics, Alan King and... Tootie, you know, from Car 54. Remember
sure.
that?
Oh, sure.
Yeah, because I was so excited one time. She called me from the club because I was a big Tootie fan. And Tootie got on the phone and went, ooh, ooh. And that was, of course, now a few people are remembering Tootie. She was, you know, I mean, she was a really wonderful dancer. I mean, she could dance even, you know, I mean, you know, now she can't dance too much. But, I mean, she was like, she could always get all the latest steps, you know, rock and, you know, the Froog, the Monkey, you know, Watusi, all that.
What did she wear as a dancer?
Oh, I see what you're trying to get at. Not much, but the essential parts, she could get on hard copy. You know, she had enough to get on hard copy, but very little. I mean, very little. I think technically it was, you know, she was dressed, but it was just she was pushing the envelope. In fact, I think she was wearing an envelope. I think that's what it was.
Well, what I want to really get at is I think for many children, they try not to think of their mothers as sexual
naked.
People,
yeah.
as naked people.
Yeah.
And mothers usually go along with them and pretend that they don't have a sexual life.
Oh.
But could you have that illusion with your own mother?
No. In fact, I mean, when I was a kid, of course, you're not uptight about the body. So everything seemed normal that my mother was, you know, out there in very skimpy little, you know, G-string, not quite pasties, a little bit more than pasties. I don't know exactly what the terminology is in belly dance wear. But I know that my mother was very proud of her cleavage and really tried to expose it, you know, even in the coldest weather and at any, you know, early hour of the day. And when my parents split up and she remarried, I went to a new school. And then I started learning the ways of the world. And she was a housewife then. Her husband made her stop dancing and be a housewife. And she came to my parent open school day, and
yeah.
the parents came.
Yeah.
But she was like the only parent, you know, the only mother there in a low-cut dress. And the boys, you know, these were like, you know, 13-year-old boys. Oh, the hormones were popping. I mean...
And what about you?
I was starting to realize that my mother was different than other mothers about that time, you know, in her dress and like, you know, beehive thing and, you know, lots, you know, Cody pink lipstick. I realized that she was definitely very beautiful and special, and she was really making me embarrassed sometimes, yeah.
Well, you had a kind of a mantra, which was,
I'll never be like my mother. And it didn't work. I mean, I am becoming more like my mother. I sing like my mother. She would sing around the house. You know, whenever she got dressed, she would always sing, and it was always in her own special style. What a difference. La, 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 la. She knew so many songs and none of the words, and neither do I.
She had certain beauty tips and beauty ideas and theories that she imparted to you. What were some of that wisdom that she was trying to impart to you about being a woman or being female?
Well, there were none of them sunk in really, but for instance, she would tell me Marilyn Monroe is so beautiful because every night she sleeps in her brassiere, and I believed it. And when Marilyn died, and they said it was barbiturates, I suspected that it was actually a maiden form overdose. she saved articles from the National Enquirer on how to stay young. Very scientific research she did on beauty, and she read in Photoplay that Elke Sommer, the great Swedish blonde movie actress and role model to many Latinas, Elke did a weekly purifying mask. So my mother rushed out and got a big jar of this Queen Helene Green Beauty Cream, and she would have this Godzilla head, you know, this mask, and not be able to really move a muscle on her. You know, she just couldn't move. This was always a good time to give her a report card to sign if you got a bad grade, you know, because she couldn't really get on my case too much, very loud or expressive.
So she was interested in the blonde movie stars.
Well, I mean, yeah,
those were her
was,
role models.
She was, she had that white Kim Novak, you know, shade hair, white Marilyn. Yeah, it was white. I mean, I don't even know if that's called blonde. I thought blonde has a little yellow, but I guess it's blonde. It's white blonde.
So she obviously bleached her hair.
Yes, yes. In fact, I would have to help her bleach, you know, her hair sometimes, and I'd miss big spots, and, oh, I'd be in so much trouble. You know, because you'd have to go to the nightclub, you know, with mostly all white hair and then this big little, you know, dark blotch in the back.
Do you look in any way like your mother?
Well, I think I'm actually, as far as my face, I think it's a blend of two of them, but I feel like I have her body. Mine can't dance, but, you know, I could put on that little outfit if I wanted to, and I think I'd look okay. It's a generous, full-course meal body. And the thing that really freaks me out is just when I... when it's, you know, it's all the stuff inside. I mean, when I hear it in my voice, you know, when I'm saying something kind of feminine, like, can you help me? I can't do it. Now, did you hear my mother there, Marty?
Yeah,
that's not me. Ooh. And, you know, I yawn, start to yawn like her.
Well, she's a very distinctive yawn.
She had a five-part yawn.
Well, so,
and always, you know, so now I'm like
you do that
four.
Now.
I do four, but if I... please shoot me, because that would just be the worst. I mean, that just drove me nuts as a teenager. That's when she started yawning, because she had to be a housewife, so she was a little bored. So it's a lot of the sound of her, and sometimes, you know, just I'm moving like her, and I am getting, you know, more femmy as I get older, yeah.
Well, I want to talk some more, but first we just have to take a very short break, and I'm speaking today on Fresh Air with performer Marga Gomez, and her one-woman show, Memory Tricks, is about her stormy and complex relationship with her mother, who was an exotic dancer and now has Alzheimer's disease. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. I'm speaking with performer Marga Gomez. Now, the other part of your piece, Memory Tricks, really is your relationship with your mother since she got diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease. When did she get that diagnosis?
She got that, I guess it's almost about 5 years ago now, in 88, that she got the diagnosis. And it was very hard for me because the first part of Memory Tricks is the account of my trying to get her attention and her focus and not getting it. And then there was a really major distancing. I mean, I moved to San Francisco and hardly talked at all. And she wasn't really reaching out herself. But I let it go. And of course, when I found out she had Alzheimer's, I started to blame myself and just was so guilty that I hadn't tried a little harder to connect or get over my anger or disappointment with her over the years. It was 5 years ago.
Were there some early signs? Some kind of tip-off signs?
My mom was always very spacey, ditzy, you know, you could say. And in fact, I was doing stand-up comedy. I mean, I still do. And sometimes I would use her in my act as, oh, you know, my mom's such a ditz, what, you know, blah, 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 like many comics do anyways. Then the joke was on me after a few years. So it was really hard to tell because, I mean, you know, when she was, you know, 28, she was not able to find car keys, you know, and then she really couldn't find car keys and her glasses. And, you know, she drove through the garage. I mean, she just drove through the garage door. You know, that is a tip off right there. And then, of course, the thing that it will always be a mystery to me and my sister is when she took off. You know, she had other kids when she remarried. She took off to Paris in 83. The man that she married, she had problems with, and I guess she got really mad at him. And plus, she always wanted to be French. She just disappeared, took off to Paris. And you
went there to look for her.
Yeah, my stepfather, I have to say, he did buy me a plane ticket. I went thinking that I would find her, just I'd put myself in her heels, her high heels, and go where she would go. Or, you know, she'd find me. You know, I would just do something wrong, and she'd find me. I'd, you know, go to the Eiffel Tower, light up a joint, something like that. She'd find me. I never found her. And she came back about a year later, and he filed for divorce and then sort of did like a psychological warfare on her, I believe. I'm not saying that's why she got Alzheimer's, but she just seemed to be cracking up after that.
Well, one of the things that you seem to notice, and perhaps this is more of a giveaway even than her forgetfulness, was that you noticed her hair was dirty.
Well, yeah, I think that's really when she was hitting bottom, and I'm sure that that's when it was really coming up for her. And so that was, you know, 6 or 7 years ago. I went to visit her. Yeah, I went to visit her, and it had been maybe a year or 6 months, and I was, you know, she always kept herself looking good, and her roots were, you know, out. Her roots were, and they were gray. You know, they were all gray. And I don't even think I knew what her real hair color was ever. I don't think I ever saw it. You know, I saw darkness, but I could never really tell what it was all like altogether. And now it was gray, and she was sleeping in the guest room because she didn't want to sleep with my stepfather. And that room was all trashed, and her bed was broken. And, you know, I thought it was the marriage.
What's your mother like now?
Well, now she's very different in a much later stage than where Memory Tricks is frozen in time in 1990. And since that time, she's deteriorated a lot, and she's in a very late stage. So I believe that she knows when I'm there. And that I can, you know, I mean, I talk to her. I do the lines from the show, which I hope, you know, she likes. I feel that she's there on a level. I feel it's like being buried alive.
Mm.
But people will go, you know, and when I go, she's in a hospital now. People go, does she know you? I hate that question. Yes, she knows me. You know, what am I supposed to say? No, she doesn't know me. I'm just here because I'm an idiot. Yes, she knows me. But now she can't move much, and she doesn't make even a sound, and it's hard to get her to eat.
Can she look at you?
She can. She looks at me, and her eyes don't quite focus in. So it's really a late stage.
Now, when you wrote Memory Tricks, this was a couple of years ago, and your mother's condition was not quite as severe as it is today. Did she know that you were doing this piece about her and you together?
No. I mean, unless she knows it now, because I tell her. And, I don't know how she'd feel about it. You know, I think if there's an afterlife and I would run into her, I'd have to deal with it then. She'd probably slap me around heaven or something. You know?
Why?
Well, because maybe she's, you know, she'd be mad. She was pretty strict and private and all that. But I was grieving, and the work I do is I talk about what's happening in my life, and I could not skip over it. And I also feel like I wanted to make her famous. I wanted to give her a tribute. I wanted to do that with both my parents. You know, that's what they wanted their whole lives. And I think when people see Memory Tricks, the feedback I've gotten is that they love my mother. Or, you know, my mother's like your mother. And so she's living on. And in a way, I think she got what she wanted.
Margo Gomez, thank you so much for joining us on Fresh Air today.
Thank you, Marty. It was my pleasure.
Performance artist Margo Gomez. She's currently performing Memory Tricks at the Edinburgh Festival in Scotland. In November, she'll be performing in Marin County, California, and Eugene, Oregon. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. Coming up from the archives, humor, writing, and family secrets, we talk with novelist Ben Cheever about his second humorous novel, The Partisan, and about being the son of the late Pulitzer Prize-winning writer, John Cheever. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Sleeps with Angels, the new collaboration between Neil Young and the band Crazy Horse. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Florida Governor Lawton Chiles says he's ready to help with a new U.S. policy on Cuban refugees. Chiles says he'll provide any detention facilities that might be needed under the new policy. The Clinton administration is abandoning a nearly 30-year-old policy of releasing Cuban refugees into the community. They'll now be put into detention. The move comes after Chiles declared a state of emergency in Florida yesterday because of the influx of Cuban boat people. President Clinton told reporters at a news conference today that senators struggling to come up with a compromise health reform plan should not get discouraged and should keep on working. NPR's Patricia Naiman reports.
The delayed debate on health reform, the president told reporters, could mean losing momentum altogether, along with the chance to reform the health care system. For 60 years, he said, Americans have acknowledged that not covering all citizens was a problem. The numbers of uninsured have increased dramatically in just the last 5 years, and costs have been exploding over the past decade. As for the self-styled mainstream group of Republican and Democratic senators now working to fine-tune a compromise plan, President Clinton cautioned that to scale back too much could do more harm than good. Most compromise plans now on the table, including this new bipartisan one, stop far short of President Clinton's original promise to provide health insurance coverage for all Americans. I'm Patricia Naiman reporting.
Fire crews in Washington state say hot, dry weather could hurt their work to control a major wildfire. Firefighters are trying to control the massive Tyee Creek fire, which has burned 126,000 acres. Full containment is expected by Monday. Firefighters say they're quite hopeful. This is the one-year anniversary of the first Israeli-Palestinian agreement. Israeli Foreign Minister Shimon Peres today met with PLO leader Yasser Arafat in Gaza. NPR's Linda Gradstein reports.
1 year ago today, the world was stunned when Israel and the PLO announced they had reached an agreement for Palestinian self-rule after months of secret negotiations. Since then, Israel has withdrawn from the West Bank town of Jericho and most of the Gaza Strip and is now planning to turn over areas such as health and education to the Palestinians throughout the West Bank. But there are still tensions between the two sides. Peres, the most senior Israeli leader to meet the PLO chief in Gaza, today demanded that Arafat do more to stop attacks by Muslim extremists on Israelis. Arafat said he will not let these extremists destroy the peace accord. He, in turn, demanded that Israel fulfill its agreement to release more Palestinian prisoners. Israel began freeing more than 200 today, but said they must stay in Jericho. I'm Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem.
Stock prices closed mixed today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrials lost a fraction of a point to end at 3,755. Trading was heavy. This is NPR. A number of countries are offering aid to Algeria after yesterday's earthquake. It occurred in the western part of the country, and at least 164 people were killed. Rescue workers are trying to help some of the 10,000 other people who've been affected by the quake. The BBC's Alf Hermida reports from Algeria.
The Algerian authorities have mounted a large relief operation in the west of the country to cope with the 10,000 people affected by Thursday's earthquake. The government has promised to rehouse the thousands left homeless by the disaster. For the time being, tents have been sent to the area to provide temporary shelter. Other relief supplies, such as food and medicines, have been pouring into the worst affected areas in the region of Mascara. Several countries have offered to help the earthquake victims. Algeria's former colonial ruler, France, has promised to send humanitarian aid. Kuwait has also pledged medical and food supplies, while Italy has donated several hundred thousand dollars in aid. In Algeria, only the Red Crescent has been authorized to receive and distribute donations for the earthquake victims.
Al Fermita reporting. The UN says that Zaire won't close its border with Rwanda after all. The UN's High Commissioner for Refugees said initially that Zaire would close its border at Bukavu today. Officials wanted to prevent a flood of refugees. That's expected once the French abandon a security zone in southwest Rwanda. But UN officials now say the Zairean government is only reserving the right to seal the border. There's a new call for a federal investigation of the Agriculture Secretary, Mike Espy. Former workers of Diamond Walnut Growers are asking for it. The company fired 600 workers in 1991 after they struck at the beginning of the harvest. Since then, the Teamsters Union has been trying to stop federal subsidies that the walnut industry uses for foreign advertising. But union officials say Secretary Espy's relationship with the firm has made that impossible. A lobbyist for Diamond Walnut Growers has hosted a party for Espy last year, attended by about 150 people. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. Having a famous writer as a father is a hard act to follow, especially if you want to be a writer yourself. Ben Cheever is the son of John Cheever, the Pulitzer Prize-winning short story writer and novelist. Ben worked as an editor at Reader's Digest for 10 years before he edited a collection of his father's letters and turned to writing full-time. He then wrote his first novel, published in 1992, called, of all things, The Plagiarist. His newest novel, called The Partisan, is a humorous and touching portrait of the family of Jonas Collingwood, a critically acclaimed and publicly ignored writer of gloomy novels. Collingwood has been offered a hefty advance to write a memoir of his experiences in World War II. The book is to be called The Partisan. In Ben Cheever's hands, the story explores the powerful dynamic between Collingwood and his adopted son and the corrosive nature of family secrets. Ben Cheever works at home these days, writing and taking care of his children. He's married to New York Times film critic Janet Maslin. I talked with Ben Cheever last March. Let's begin with a reading from the opening of The Partisan.
That was the summer I worked for the Westchester Commons. I was in love with Amy Snodgrass Rose. Amy was in love with David Hitchens. David was in love with Gloria Thomas. I was in Westchester. Amy was in Washington State. David was in Montreal. Gloria had gone to Paris. The sex was very safe, and I was very lonely.
What I like so much about that is a kind of rhythm that you set up, and also, of course, the humor that moves through that paragraph, but also throughout the whole book.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have to work at that?
When I was a kid, people thought I was funny, and I would try and write funny things, and sometimes I'd write one funny thing, and then I'd try again, and I'd write something that wasn't funny. And there's nothing more awful than something that's supposed to be funny and is not. Then, when I started really spending a lot of time writing, I discovered that what you wrote was something sad, and it turns out to be funny. If you wrote something that happened that was sad, and you made it a little sadder than it was, and you tell it to people, they think it's hilarious.
And why is that? Because it's happening to someone else and not them? The difference between comedy and tragedy, of course.
That's right, is it's happening to someone else. I think that's part of it, but I think also sadness creates humor. I mean, you laugh at sad things. When my father died, the day the family all got together to go to the funeral, we were all in hysterics. And at the funeral, in fact, people were quite critical. But that's just how we react to things that we find unpleasant.
How would you describe Nelson? And he's the person that tells the story.
Well, I like him a lot, but he's more an observer. He's less active than maybe he ought to be. He's not sure what he wants. He wants desperately to be liked. And one of the critics who didn't like the book said that this was adolescent, and that Nelson cares terribly about having people love him, and this is an adolescent phase. And I'm 45.
And
I still desperately care about having people like me. I don't know what I'm supposed to go on to. I mean, what is, if you don't terribly want the approval of other people, then what is it you do want? Do you want money? Is that more important than the approval of other people? Do you want fame? Do you want cleaner highways? I don't know what it is that's more important than having other people like you.
Well, I'd love to have you read another section from this book, and this is the beginning. It's actually on page 55.
All right.
This is chapter 6.
Okay. I'm glad you asked me to read this, because in some ways I think it's the heart of the book. I've always been mystified by the interest adult adopted children take in their biological parents. They appear on TV, they write books, they are careful to explain that they have wonderful adoptive parents, but still they want to track down the real ones. What in God's name are these people looking for? Don't they know that by the time they're 21, they've had the only childhood they're entitled to? There's something ridiculous about the search, those big, sad faces yearning for a missing babyhood. They should get drunk instead, or hit somebody, or cry. Bloodlines have always seemed to me to be entirely beside the point. Love is a choice. Families are made, not found. Those pivotal connections are forged by some mysterious alchemy of tenderness and cruelty, not by the matching of genetic fingerprints. What is this mania for real parents? Your real parents are the ones you have. Romulus and Remus were suckled by a wolf. They founded Rome. Winston Churchill was brought up by a nanny. He hardly even saw his biologicals. Once you're raised, you're raised. Don't some gestalt therapists claim that it's never too late for a happy childhood? Nonsense. It's conceivable that the victim of a disastrous upbringing can become happy, or at least a successful adult, but he'll never become a happy child. Not unless you drop him on his head. Still, I suppose I should take the time to explain how it was that Sister and I came to be raised by strangers. I'm not as interested in this as are the viewers of 60 Minutes, but here it is. We were both adopted by Elspeth's sister Lily and by her husband Hamilton Ballard. The Ballards lived across the Hudson in Montvale, New Jersey. They were childless. Hamilton, a lawyer, was deeply involved in school politics. When a bright young girl whom he had been counseling got pregnant, he was the first one she told. She was then a senior at the local high school, with a full scholarship to a distinguished college. The father was said to have been an auto mechanic. The unborn child threatened to ruin her life. The Ballards sent Miss X to a lodge in New Hampshire, and in the fullness of time they adopted the baby boy. That was 1971. I was that baby.
And that's my guest, Ben Cheever, reading from his latest novel called The Partisan. As a parent, do you feel the tug of biology? Are you immune to that? When you look at your sons, you say, I made that?
No, I don't say I made that. It seems very mysterious to me that this other creature, so complete, should have any biological connection to me. And when I first saw a baby, the first time I ever saw a baby that was mine, my reaction was horror.
Horror?
Well, yes. We had a black Labrador, and when she had puppies, I remember she was shocked. She thought, I guess, that she was constipated, and suddenly there was this little yowling thing, one of many, it turned out. And her first reaction was fright and horror, and that was my first reaction to being a father. This entity, and children seem to bring their own destiny with them, really, into the world, with its own needs.
Well, and what interests me in that section is that it seems to run counter to a certain trend to reclaim a childhood, to go back and take one's teddy bear, spiritual teddy bear, one's actual teddy bear, and try to recapture, relive a certain elusive happiness. And does that bother you, this trend to reconstruct childhood and do it right somehow?
Well, it does bother me. I think what bothers me most is the idea that we can be made happier by blaming our parents. And obviously, part of the reason I take this position now is I'm becoming more a parent and less a child. But I think that's an unhelpful way of looking at life. I don't think blame works. I don't think it's a good thing to get too heavily involved in.
Where do you think that comes from? Because it seems very culturally driven.
Well, I don't know. I think there's an unwillingness, and this may be because of advertising, to accept how difficult life is. I think life is difficult. I think it's difficult for parents and for children. It's difficult for rich people and poor people. I think it's really tough, and we're not supposed to accept that. It's supposed to be fun. We're supposed to always be buying great things that are making us happy and our lives simpler, and we're supposed to love everyone around us, and that's not my experience. So I find life disappointing, and one way to solve that disappointment is to blame my terrible parents.
Did you go through a period of that?
Well, sure. I mean, we all do. I certainly did. A period where I felt alienated from them. I felt that they were part of a world that was corrupt and that I was never going to be part of, that they were hypocritical, that they were overly materialistic, that they didn't love each other in a way that I accepted, or me. I remember screaming at my father once, "You don't know anything about love. You don't know the first thing about love." And I think a lot of the things I thought about them were true, but what I didn't understand was why they felt that way and how hard it is not to feel that way and how hard they had worked and what sacrifices they had made for me.
My guest is Ben Cheever. His latest novel is called The Partisan. We'll talk more after a short break. This is Fresh Air. I'm speaking with novelist Ben Cheever. His latest novel is called The Partisan.
Well, this book is also about family secrets, and of course, all families have them, and I don't want to give the end of the story away either, but would you say that the secrets are always destructive? Because there's sometimes a fine line between secrets and privacy even within a family.
Well, I'm not sure secrets are always destructive. My father had a big secret, which was that he was bisexual, and I have very mixed feelings about that. I don't think he would have been the wonderful writer he was if he hadn't been the person he was, and the person he was bisexual. He was actively homophobic, or talked that way when he was around and before he came to grips with this at the end of his life, and that confused me, I think. I think it might have been better. I'm pretty sure it would have been better for me if I'd known earlier that he had very mixed feelings about homosexuality.
And my understanding is that he told you about his bisexuality just a couple of weeks before he died.
Right.
When he told you that, did it explain some certain things? Did it turn your head around a little bit?
Yeah, it spun my head around. I was confused for quite a while afterwards. I'm still a little confused about it, but. I'm not sure that he would have been a happier person had he lived a different life. I think he lived the life he wanted to live. There are people who think that he should have just expressed himself as bisexual early on and it would have been simple and he should not have had a family. There's a problem with that. If he'd not had a family, I wouldn't be around. Things are complicated, and I think he wanted to have a family, and I think he was a pretty decent father, and I think my mother and he loved each other, sometimes very intensely, and sometimes they hated each other, but I think that's what happened.
And what you're saying is confusing is the impulse to choose to be either heterosexual or homosexual, and that bisexuality somehow is even more confusing than those two ends of the spectrum?
Well, what was confusing to me was that I was taught or led to believe, not entirely by him, also by other people, that relationships with women were always going to be dangerous and mysterious, and that I was always in danger when I was in the presence of a woman I found attractive, but that relationships with men, because the sexual element was entirely missing, were safe, and I could be comfortable and noisy and messy around men, and it wouldn't be held against me. And then suddenly I discovered that I was quite mistaken about this, and that there was a sexual element in relationships with men much more than I'd seen it. And that was very confusing to me.
Did you think when you realized or you were told by your father that he was bisexual that then you would be bisexual, or that whatever sexuality you thought you had, you didn't have?
I had a little while there where I thought, well, probably it was possible that I was. I was married at this point, and I thought, well, maybe I am gay, and the reason I wasn't is because I was so frightened of his disapproval. And I waited for my gayness to express itself, and it didn't. And I noticed that when I thought of being being naughty, it was always with a woman. So I thought that probably I wasn't gay. And gay men have told me that this is not an arbitrary decision they make. This is something that's made for them.
Let me get back to something that you wrote about and about working at home. You said that you look for adult companionship, at least be able to sort of check in with someone during the day as you're home working and taking care of the kids. Do you call women? Do you call men?
Well, if it's been a real bad day, a lot of times I have my mother come over. She'll come over in the evening and help me with the kids, and we can talk a little bit. I call my sister a lot, too. During the day, if I can, I'll run with another guy.
Mm-hmm.
But it's more apt to be mixed. In the old days, all my friends were men, and I had a lot of very good men friends. And that's not true now.
Are you a pretty dedicated runner?
Yeah, I'm a compulsive runner.
Okay.
Is what I am.
Which means how much do you run?
Well, it means that I recently, just in the last couple of weeks, I've been going to the gym. But it means I run 45 minutes a day, every day. I have a ski machine, so when I absolutely can't go out, I can do it inside. And if I don't do it, I get in a terrible mood. And I will get up at 4 o'clock in the morning to do it if I have to. It's a drug. I think it's less harmful than some other drugs, mm-hmm. but it's a drug, and I miss it terribly if I don't have it. And I'm quite selfish about it, too. I
mean, what do you get?
Well, I've got a little voice in the back of my head that says that I'm a jerk. And if I pause, if I'm not completely involved, this little voice kicks in and it says, "You're a jerk, Ben." And if I run hard for 40 or 45 minutes, it shuts up. It's not replaced with a voice that says, "You're great." But it just shuts up. And that's a wonderful thing.
Right. Yeah. Are you working on another book?
That's right. I'm about, I hope, a third of the way through a third novel.
Some writers love writing. Some of them love rewriting. Some of them love editing. Is there a part that you enjoy?
I love getting something right. Or close to right. That's very, very gratifying. I will put it off any way I can, and I make myself do it every day, because if I didn't do it every day, I probably wouldn't ever do it again.
Really?
Yeah, every time I get away from it. Well, then I sit down and I think, you know, why don't you get a job? Why are you sitting here by yourself imagining something? Why would anyone be interested in that? Whereas if I do it every day, it's a habit. I don't have to ask that.
And that's that voice that says you're a jerk?
Yeah, it says you're a jerk. And why would you think you're a novelist? I mean, what a pretentious title for a person to take on.
Novelist Ben Cheever is the son of writer John Cheever. Ben Cheever's latest book is called The Partisan. This is Fresh Air.
I'm Linda Wertheimer. Coming up today on All Things Considered, the president's decision to change the status of refugees from Cuba. We'll hear what the president said about it at the White House today. We'll explain the law and hear the reaction in Miami and in Havana. President Clinton also talked about the crime bill, about health, and about his birthday. Mara Liasson will have a report. We will hear about the Mexican elections from David Wellner. The elections are coming up this weekend. Also a report on fires and firefighters in the West, and dreams of baseball and letters from camp. That's later today on All Things Considered from National Public Radio.
When Neil Young collaborates with the band Crazy Horse, he's frequently made some of the most raucous hard rock of his career. On their new release, however, called Sleeps with Angels, Young and Crazy Horse are turning down the volume. Rock critic Ken Tucker has a review. From the album, here's My Heart.
Down in the valley, the shepherd sees the flock is close at hand. Night sky, a star is falling down from someone's hand. Somewhere, somewhere, I gotta get somewhere. It's not too late, it's not too late. I gotta get somewhere this time.
Sleeps with Angels finds Neil Young in a calm, contemplative mood most of the time. That song, called My Heart, ambles on in a way that eventually turns the tune into a lullaby. You know, I love an awful lot of Neil Young's music, so I'm sort of circling around the truth, which is that My Heart is sort of a pretty bore, and so is much of the rest of this album.
Frontier town, home of the Western hero. Frontier justice, dealt with the iron hand.
He wore a long coat to the ground. He wore big boots that made a sound.
He wore a long coat to the ground. He wore big boots that made a sound. Even by the less is more standards that Neil Young frequently applies to his homespun melodies, these are pretty banal lyrics. Much of Sleeps with Angels sounds like the work of guys who wanted to get together and make music without having much to say. That's the only reason I can think of to explain Change Your Mind, a song that's longer than 14 minutes and which goes cheerfully, complacently nowhere. Then there's the actively annoying stuff, like Blue Eden. Well, that's quite enough of that. This being a Neil Young and Crazy Horse album, there are regular flashes of beautifully crafted music, and there are times when Young's aimlessness suits the tune, but not often enough. Next time, Neil, a loud, messy album, please?
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for Entertainment Weekly. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Naomi Person, Phyllis Myers, and Amy Sallet, with Seuss Bolin, Jewel Bracey, and Kathy Wolf. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Technical direction for Fresh Air is from Audrey Bentham. Our theme music was written by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. For Terry Gross, I'm Artie Moscow-Wayne.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, our postponed interview with poet David White about using poetry as a beacon and a tool if you feel lost in the working world. I'm Artie Moscow-Wayne, and I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.